Hello and welcome to this Adoption and Fostering podcast special edition with me, Scott Casson Renee.
And me, Al Coates. Oh, Scott, what have we done?
What have you done? Not what have we done, what have you done?
Right.
I know. Where do we start? Right. So Al sent an email. No, actually, Al sent a tweet months ago.
Hey, Josh
McAllister.
Hey, Josh, yeah. come and let us interview you.
Come on, podcast, lad.
Come on, podcast. Everything will be fine, lad. And he got back to us straight away and said, yeah, of course I will, but I really need to get some work done first. Not unreasonable.
Yeah. Which was, I don't think so. Yeah. But I think that was before kind of, seemed like a good idea.
Well, I guess the background, if people haven't been watching on Twitter, is that the Independent Review of Children's Social Care has literally caused a storm amongst certain communities, and it's incredibly controversial. It's kind of, its very foundation is being questioned. And against that backdrop, I guess the caveat to this interview, because we've not done it yet, literally we're about to speak to him in a few minutes.
We're psyching up to it.
I guess the caveat is that the nature of the interviews that we do are they're not confrontational. It's a conversation about the work that he's doing and why he's doing it. So I think we have to, as you listen to it, please bear that in mind. And we are what we are.
Exactly.
Well, with no further ado.
I mean, I don't know who I feel more sorry for, me or you, because I didn't message him.
No, I don't have a problem with that. I think that
idle thumbs. This is what happens.
Yeah, it is true, isn't it? It did seem like a good idea at the time, but I think that it's important that we have those questions, but also we come with an open mind, because I think that there's been lots of stuff, accusations around the very foundations of it, and maybe they're true and legitimate. We can have that. I want to have a conversation with him. I don't want to have a Jeremy Paxman style. Tell me the truth kind of moment. So,
and I think you've hit the nail on the head. Open-minded. I'm trying to go into this open-minded. I'm sure you are as well. Oh, we've got questions. Of course we have. If you're going to listen, then we'd probably ask you to do the same.
That seems only reasonable. So let's go and find Josh.
Let's find him.
Hello, Josh. Thank you very much for coming on our podcast and then agreeing to talk to us. Much appreciated.
Great to be here. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's the right thing to say. I'm setting the tone as we go. For people who maybe are not that familiar with you and the work that you're doing in relation to the Independent Review of Children's Social Care, could you give us a brief summary of what the review is, how you got to be doing the review, that kind of stuff,
So the review was in the government's manifesto at the last election. It was one of the few things that the Conservative Party committed to in the manifesto that was related to children's social care. Most political parties don't have much to say about children's social care at election times. But the Conservative Party did, and they said, the limited bit that they did say was, we're going to have a review of care, and there was no further detail to that. And when they won the election, they did start putting their minds to, what were the questions I might want to be asking? What was this review going to be looking at? It took them a bit of time to do that. I think probably delayed in large part because of COVID, like lots of other things. And so they have commissioned a review, which is not run by anybody in government. It's not run by the civil service. Some reviews are. And in that sense, it's independent. And it's looking at the whole of children's social care. So everything from how we support and help families when they might be struggling, right the way through to children in care and adults, young adults who are leaving care. So that the full spectrum. And there is something quite powerful about doing that, because it means you can look at the themes that run across parts of the system. And we've had lots of reviews of parts of the system. So this review is different in its breadth. And I was asked to do the review by ministers because I've taken a sort of slightly different innovative approach, I would say, to how we've recruited and trained social workers over the last 8 years. And I think they were keen to get a fresh pair of eyes on the system. So I began work in March this year, only just over 3 months ago now, and have been working working flat out since then to get the review underway. So yeah, that's a bit of the background.
And when is the review due to conclude?
Well, in sort of government speak, it is spring of 2022, which I am taking literally, but there are people who seem to think that government only has two seasons, which are spring and autumn.
All right, so that's...
can be interpreted. Spring can be interpreted in quite broad terms. So yeah, you know, spring 2022. So it's about a year. I mean, it could be about 15 months or so, but we're planning to do it so that by spring next year, we've got a set of recommendations and a report that we're able to publish and put to government and say, look, you know, this is what we think you should be doing.
Thank you. That's sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Scott, I've got a question already. Sorry, already? It's probably on Al's list, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Is that not like really quick for something that's, you know, like, oh, I don't know, yeah. I don't know how to describe it, but you know, children's social care is like, you know, it's probably one of the biggest things in this country. Is
after the NHS, it will be, won't it?
Yeah.
Is huge.
That not like quick?
It is. It is quick. The government looked at different lengths of time to do reviews of various different parts of the public sector. So, for example, the Augar review, the original plan for that, I think, was for it to be an 18-month review. That's the whole of higher and further education. This review is going to be about 15 months. When you look back at the Munro review, the times are not that dissimilar. Mm. When you look at the New Zealand review of the care system, that was, I think, under a year. I think about 9 months, and they looked at, you know, the full spectrum of children's social care. The Scottish Review, which did some amazing work on engagement with young people, people who've got lived experience of children's social care, took about 3 years. Yeah. So I think you can, I mean, we could debate the rights and wrongs of whether, you know, 12 months is right. Should it have been 18 months? Should it be 3 years? I do think, having looked at some of the problems and themes over the last 3 months, there is some real urgency to some of this stuff. And actually, there is a political reality to the fact that we've got a parliament, the government's got a majority. We could get some important work done in this parliament, some of which might involve legislation. And so kind of seizing the opportunity of the review to get it done well by spring 2022, which I think we can do, and we have been working at pace to do that, which is why we've published the case for change in the first 3 months, does give the opportunity to actually implement and deliver change before the next election, assuming the next election is, you know, 4 years after the last, which is a big assumption. But that's a really important point, because if we took 2 years or 3 years, any hard, you know, hard work that had been done on the review with hundreds of people contributing to it would deliver a set of recommendations and a report, which could very well be given to government. And then there isn't the window of opportunity to do anything with it before an election. And then it's into a new parliament. And by that point, politics has moved on. So it's hard to convey this, but there is a chance here to sort of seize the agenda.
No, see, I understand that, because you know, we've seen that before, haven't we? Where things have been put through or tried to be put through, and then a new parliament sits and it's gone.
Exactly.
So you've missed a chance.
The moment's lost. Okay. Yeah. Can I sort of, even before we get into the kind of, because you've sort of brought an interim report and that's been widely publicised here, there have been lots of comments about that, and we did put out questions to be honest. We put our questions in very limited places because I just couldn't cope with the hassle of getting the vitriol. Sort of, I didn't want to be a channel for that vitriol that I've seen on social media in relation to this. So that's, I have a couple of questions. One is, can you tell me what the impact of the passion, I'm not going to, vitriol is maybe the wrong word, passions are running really high. And I've seen personal stuff against you and against other people in part of your care, you know, the part of the team that are working around the care experience team. Can you tell me what is the impact of that? What is that? How are you managing with that? Coping with that?
Well, it's not nice. And as much as you do try to tune some of it out, especially at the weekends, I just don't look at social media at the weekends. Because I think otherwise you end up just filling your time by doom scrolling through it.
Yeah.
And I think that...
Because some of it's very personal, isn't it?
Some of it is very personal, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that part of it is I do try to say, like, play the ball, not the man. So however personal people get, what matters are the issues and what's actually going on in children's social care. And I get that for a lot of people, particularly people who've got lived experience of children's social care, they do care hugely about this system and what's going to happen in the future. And for some understandable reasons, might have anxieties about where things are headed or what the recommendations might be. And I've just tried to say to people throughout, like, wait to see what I say and where the review gets to. And we've put out quite a lot of information now in the Case for Change, which I think, you know, is a pretty detailed reflection of some of my thoughts and views.
Yeah.
There will be a small group of people who I think are just now so committed to opposing the review that, you know, I could spend all of my time trying to persuade and bring them on side. And I'm just don't think that's going to happen. And I think the sort of added layer of social media, which even if this review had been done 3 years ago, I think it would have been different, you know, given the world we're in now with social media, reviews like this get a lot of interest and attention and actually attract some of the more kind of personal and slightly abusive elements of the internet. I do try to remind myself that it's a little bit like, you know, road rage, where people are in a car next to you and there's something about the glass in the vehicle that means people, you know, literally shout swear words and get red in the face in a way that they just wouldn't do if you're in the street with them. And I've met some of the people who are very active on Twitter. I've met them through video calls and over the years in person. And it's just a completely different conversation when you're speaking to people. And I just try to remember that, really, that, you know, Twitter is a tiny window into a bit of the world. The rest of it is out there off screen. And when you actually speak to the people at the other end of the device, you can still have a really reasonable, rational discussion, disagreement, of course, but, you know, it's just different.
And what about the support for the experts by experience members? You know, I've seen Chris Wilde has been quite good, actually, at getting his point across about some of the criticism and stuff. How are these guys supported? Because, you know, for some of these guys, there's stuff in that for them, isn't there? You know, I mean, I know briefly your background, but, you know, these guys are, you know, potentially
they've got skin in the game,
a lot of harm. They? Yeah,
They do. I mean, the team actually working on the review and myself are in touch with the experts by experience board members all the time. Reaching out and checking in, just making sure they're okay. And they are, you know, they are doing all right. And I think, you know, part of it for them is they're in a tricky spot, because I think some people perceive them as being, you know, endorsing absolutely everything the review might say or think. From the get-go, that's not been the purpose of the Expert by Experience Board. It's to advise and offer some challenge and some insights into the review. And I've been really clear that we're not saying that they are, you know, signed up to everything that we might end up saying at the end of the day. We need that diversity of views. Mm-hmm. And I think that that early on in the review, I didn't do a good enough job of communicating to people. And it's hard to sort of cut through some of the noise of saying, look, this group isn't representing the world of people with lived experience. It's not the representative group. And so I think some people have looked at it and said, well, you know, these three people are care experience, therefore they're the only people representing care experience people in the room.
They're speaking for that whole community, and they're not, are they? Yeah.
They're not, and they're not claiming to, and we've never claimed that they are. But I do think that if people look at it and see it that way, you know, they then want to make sure that the people on the board have got their interests understood and that they're making their points for them. And there's loads of different ways that we're hearing from people with lived experience in the review. So I think that's kind of, that's part of where some of the heat comes from.
So we can use the headline, Lead of Care Review Admits Communication Failure. That's what we're going to go with.
human admits to not getting everything right.
To being human, I mean, that's all good, but I do think that it seems not unreasonable that we look at some of the specific criticisms, and you may not be able to answer them, but I think it's maybe a right of reply almost. So one of them is in relation to independence and the sort of this question mark that, you know, you've had quite strong links to the DFE. You've been, you know, through Frontline, which is the social work training program, which is in of itself is controversial, part of this sort of neo-conservative wave. And so there's this concern that there's a bit of chumminess going on, that you got the job, and then people are drawing that forwards and saying, is the review just a Trojan horse for actually that you're going to come out with a message that says we need to deregulate the system and you're going to bring in private equity, which is maybe there's a lot of accusations in that. But there is, you know, each one of them has been quite articulated quite well by a lot of people, and you know, they've brought out spreadsheets and everything. So come on then.
Very elaborate spider diagrams.
Yes. Convince me that isn't the agenda. You're not, it's not jobs for the boys, and you're going to, then private equity is going to fill the gap that you're going to create.
Well, look, on private equity, privatization, that is not my agenda. That's not my interest. In fact, where the private sector has got a significant role at the moment and is making significant profits, I have made it really clear that's a concern. So that is just not the direction the review is taking. We're not making recommendations at this stage, but I don't think I can be any clearer that the agenda of privatisation, of selling off parts of children's social care, of allowing people to make profit out of this really important service, is not something I am instinctively in favour of. It's not something that the evidence points to. It's just not where this is headed. In saying that, the people who believe that will continue to believe that come what may. That is just not where it's headed. My background is I started my career as a secondary school teacher. I set up and ran a charity, you know, which has its accounts made public. You can see them. They are there. It had a board of trustees. It had a social purpose. I'm very proud of the work that I did and the team did at Frontline, continues to do really good work. And that the origins of that are, you know, me and a team of people setting up Frontline with an idea. First of all, that we wanted to pilot and test out, could we get more great people into social work and give them a different way of training that would improve life for children and families? I think through the evaluations that we've had, we've done that. But at the beginning, it was a case of me persuading government and saying, look, there's a different approach that can be taken here. It shouldn't be the only way that we train social workers, but it can be an important way. And I managed to persuade government to do that. And then,
I mean, I guess
subsequent to that,
Frontline's Frontline's an interesting example, isn't it? Because I think there's a lot of social workers, include myself, who are quite cynical and skeptical and kind of question a lot of the stuff around Frontline. You say it's a success. I'm not sure that is universally held opinion or that's true, but we'll not fall out over it. You know, we're nice people. Maybe we'll have to disagree about
maybe there's another podcast in that, but I guess that the point you're making, Al, which is, does it show that I'm not independent? That the point I would make is it shows that I've been able to influence government. You know, this wasn't the government saying, we've got this thing, we're going to do it. Yeah. Oh, by the way, there's Josh and Frontline. It was the other way around. And I think that some of the accusations around independence, and I do want to respond to this and have, in a, I guess, a sort of response to it, which is, I think some of the accusations around independence come from people who confuse independence with someone who agrees with me. And they're not the same thing. And I, you know, lots of people before the appointment was made said we need an independent review without any knowledge of who the reviewer might be. And the point of an independent reviewer is that they are independent of other people's views and can take an independent look at the system. That yeah. doesn't mean I'm going to take a look at the system which agrees with people who might be critical of my take. So there is a bit of a conflation there with independent means either they've got no opinion at all, which I don't think any human being doing this review
it's could possibly not reasonable, is without it?
Any exactly any opinions, or independent means they agree with me and are therefore independent of everybody else. And when you've got a system as complicated as this with so many different viewpoints, there is no, again, there is no human being who could do this review who wouldn't come to it with some worldview, experience of family, themselves.
I mean, it is complicated, isn't it? Because in a sense, it's independent of all views. So, you know, you could align yourself with perhaps some of the other perspectives on the care system and then not be independent as well. You know, I totally get that. And I think that, I don't know, Scott and I have probably chatted about this. For me, the feeling is that ultimately the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? It's all well and good shouting, he's not independent, let's see what the review says.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, look at some of the concerns that have been there at the moment. There are people who are very enthusiastic that I've said profit making in residential care in particular is a concern, who also disagree with me when I've said that parts of children's social care are going too soon to investigation over help. So people, you know, people who are like, well, hang on, I agree with him on this and I disagree with him on this. There's people who've said he's not going to say we need any more investment. Well, I have said that. That's really clear in the case for change. People who've said, you know, I'm not going to consider poverty. Poverty is pretty prominent, I think, in the case for change. So mm-hmm. I just say to people, it's unlikely that the recommendations will come out and you'll agree with all of it. I could try and do a review like that, and I describe it in the document as a lowest common denominator review, where we basically try and find the things that we could do that would get the broadest base of support from everybody. I think the yeah. danger of doing that is that it is the lowest common denominator. You kind of pick the stuff that is easier and is more comfortable for people. And I honestly don't think that that is the best thing for children and families.
Is there a tension as well about you? Because you could literally be picking things pie out of the sky. You know, you could be saying, hey, we need to do this. Hey, we need to do that. So is there a constraint on you to kind of make it doable as well, that it's got to be within the realms of what is possible? Does that Absolutely. Alter how you're independent? Does that alter your findings?
I mean, anyone could do a review like this and say, you know, pick stuff out, which is just not going to be deliverable.
Yeah.
And government will ignore it. It doesn't matter who it is that does it. If you don't, I think, come up with a review which, first of all, diagnoses the problems, which is what we've tried to do in the case for change, and then goes through a process of thinking, what might some of the responses to those problems be that will genuinely address them? And says, okay, we need to have those solutions be ones which can be implemented soon so that change can happen. I mean, that is the test for any review, right? So absolutely. I mean, in a way, that's what makes the review quite exciting. You know, that is the challenge of it. There's these enormous issues which are impacting hundreds of thousands of people right now. We've got a government saying we're doing a review of it and we're open-minded about what the response might be. But, you know, we're not asking for nirvana here. We've got to get on with making change happen.
Yeah.
So the recommendations need to be deliverable for sure.
Yeah.
Just before we move into some of the kind of details, what about you and your opinions and your ideas? Have you changed any of them as a result of the work that you've done so far?
Some of the conversations I've had with particular groups have given me a level of understanding which I didn't have before, mm-hmm. and have made me pause for thought about what the answers might be, right? So for example, kinship care was something I didn't know a huge amount about before starting the review. And having heard now so many stories and experiences from extended family who have tried to support their nephews or grandchildren, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and have been navigating like a very complicated arrangement of support, which is determined by the legal order for the child. And you know, all of these are kind of unintended consequences of pots of money here and there and pots of support here and there. I mean, that has sort of opened my eyes to that whole set of issues. I had, in a way, a more focused example of this would be meeting a group of care experienced adults to talk about accommodation specifically, like housing, last week. And I think it was six or seven young women, most of whom had been moved into flats that had no carpets because they'd been given flats which were just sort of complete bare bones.
Boxes.
So, you know, stuff like that, which is, it's really significant. We need to hear what's going on out there. I wasn't aware of that before. You know, I knew that housing, there were housing issues, but there's this sort of depth and to some extent visceralness with some of this stuff, which I need to hear and bear witness to, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because when you obviously you released the interim report and it was being sort of reported of in different places, and I think one of the reports I read was that someone was, you clearly said actually we need to regulate 16, 17 year olds, which is kind of, most people go absolutely, and then there was an alternative voice saying, oh, if we do that it would be terrible, if we do that it would be the end of provision, it would be the end of, and you kind of like, you even, you know, so like you say, even that, which seems like an absolute no-brainer, there's no reasonable person would argue with that, because we want to provide good quality, safe, appropriate accommodation for, say, 16, 17-year-olds. But there are voices who say, no, regulation will kill that. And that just highlights the kind of the trick or the difficulty of your role. And I'm conscious we've talked a lot about all all the criticisms. And I mean, we could go on, and I'm having... this is.
We just like gossip. That's all that is. Sorry. Well,
I'm really happy to talk about this because in a way it does, these are the conversations that are happening online, aren't they? So having an actual conversation about it, which people can listen to is I think really valuable. So ask away.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, we before we started, you know, you've been on quite a few news platforms and you've been asked questions that they've wanted to ask you and from specific areas and stuff. And I think that generally we are more kind of, well, we're a podcast for a start. We're not a news channel and we're not journalists. So, you know, it's maybe, I don't know. Anyway.
More of a conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's longer form as well. I mean, I think some of the points which have been hard to, so many of the issues that we've raised have got really important nuance to them. And we've got that nuance in the document. Of course, not everybody who's commenting on the review has read what we've written, which I get, you know, it is over 100 pages long, but there is some really important nuance in there. So there was a debate, wasn't there, a couple of weeks ago about, is the review saying that social workers are to blame for investigations of families? Yeah. And of course, I have just not said that. The document does not say that. What I say, And I think anybody who'd been in the conversations I've been having with parents and to some extent adopters and foster carers as well, actually, would recognise that there's this dynamic we're in at the moment which we have to get out of, whereby too often the first response of the system is to investigate families and not help them. That investigation and assessment often comes over and above the help. And we explain that there's important, complicated reasons for that, one of which is that the availability of services for help has reduced significantly over recent years. And we also say that, I think some of that is also culturally about the system and how it operates and thinks about families. And we need to shift that. So, I mean, I think it's a really good example where hopefully that's the kind of thing we can talk a bit more about here, that, you know, we'll reassure people that we are making nuanced points.
Well, I think that raises a really interesting point for me personally, because I am a social worker and I kind of totally got what you were saying. But then I, like you, I saw this sort of snowballing of, oh, someone said he said this, and, you know, so they're following on to tweets of a tweets of a tweet of a tweet. So there's kind of this outrage growth about, and then when you get back to it and you read the report, you go, that seems quite reasonable what has been said. And it's not attacking, you know, you're not like literally people saying he's attacking social workers. And I'm not here to be your apologist at all, but having read the report, you know, 100 pages of it, or the best I could, then marrying it up to the criticisms, going, well, hang on, you know, like even people were, you know, so one of the key things you bring out is about early intervention. So what are your views on early intervention, your interim sort of findings about, you know, because that's all built in, you know, there's finances around that, isn't there, and stuff. So what are you saying?
So importantly, or some people might not think it's at all important, but I refer to it as family help rather than early intervention. And part of the reason for that is that I think a lot of families who get what is called early help at the moment get it at a time that feels anything but early. What we, I think, have heard from parents, from care experienced people as well, who've said, you know, if my parents had been given more support, things might have been a bit different. As well as particularly parents of children with disabilities, special educational needs, is that the availability of support has reduced significantly over the last 10 years or so. And that you see at a system level this really big shift of where the money's being spent. And it is moving away from helpful services, which can be provided to families, towards crisis spending. And that once you're in that loop as a local authority of spending money on crisis services, acute spending, it becomes really hard to then control that so that you can invest into the help and reduce demand for acute services. So it becomes quite a pernicious cycle, which is hard to shake. So that's the kind of, that's the funding and system dilemma that we're in at the moment.
And is it within your remit to criticize the kind of the context of the last decade where funding has reduced, you know, in real terms, it's reduced, you know, whether it's year on year, I'm not a funding expert. Yeah. Is it within your remit to kind of say, hang on, we've got to this situation, I think, is it 129% more investigations, but the backdrop to all of this is that reduction in money. Is that a message that the government want to hear? Have they said you can't criticise us?
Well, I'm sure it's not a message the government would want to hear, but I do criticise the reduction in spending on services in children's social care directly, but also adjacent to children's social care. So, for example, spending on services for adults who've got substance misuse, substance addiction, is you know, really closely related to what happens in children's social care. So I make that point, but I also want to make the point to people who argue that that is the reason we are where we are. It's not the only reason we are where we are. Some of these trend lines were headed in the same direction in the 2000s when spending was going up.
That's complicated.
It is. I mean, that's an inconvenient fact. So you then need to think, well, if Eileen Munro was looking at this in 2011, when you'd had a period of significant increase in investment over the recent years preceding her review. And when you look at Lord Laming's reviews, both of them highlight issues around the quality of early help services. First of all, they make a point about whether early help services have got the confidence to hold risk, so that they actually work in partnership with families and do the work without feeling the anxiety of the need to escalate it and pass it on to children's social workers. So that's a really important point. And secondly, some of the evidence around what worked for improving family functioning, reducing the need for future services was, and still is to some extent, in a bit of a mess. You know, we don't really know a huge amount about the relationship between early help, family help, as we call it, and more acute services. We have in the review so far really focused on trying to dig into that. We make the point that there are some encouraging signs there that spending on good family help can reduce the need for acute services. And that's the argument we're making at the moment to bits of government. But it's, I guess what I'm saying is it is complicated. It's not just how much money spent on this stuff. It's also how it's done.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that I took out of it as well is about the quality of provision and the quality of social work. And you're talking about social work turnover, which is a huge issue, I know, for children in the social care system. But I know for us, I work in fostering, it's my day job, but I know children who had a social worker for 3 years, great. And then over a period of 6 months, they had 5 social workers. This is a temporary, this is like allocated, this person's here to stay, oh no, they're gone. And we worked out it's something like 20 working days per child, per social worker for this child. And they just, by the end of it, they were like, I don't want to see the next one. Just, why even bother? And you go, well, it's reasonable.
It's one of the messages that comes from doctors, foster carers, children, parents, other professionals working with children's social care. It comes, it's not just social workers where the turnovers are concerned. It's PAs. It's residential care staff.
Yeah.
It's the whole system. And I think that, you know, that begs a question about what's going on that means that there is this fragility in a service which is actually all about relationships. And yet, when it comes to creating the conditions where people can stay and do that really important work and build those important relationships, too often we just don't have it. It's a huge point.
I did something like last night. I was reading up and I was, you know, I had one eye on the football. If I'm blessed, I don't like football. So it's, I feel like a man released.
I was going to say, jeepers, creepers. It must have been bad if you were watching football.
Well, I was reading your report with one eye. I actually had a headache afterwards, which makes perfect sense.
That would definitely be the football that gave you the headache, not the report.
No, the report. There was pictures and everything, so it was easy to follow. The thing that came, there was a few things that came out of it really was just that there's so many moving parts. I mean, for one, there's 152 local authorities or so, and they outwork a lot of these systems differently. The same, you know, overarching frameworks are similar, but then they're worked out differently on a team by team, by local authority by local authority. How realistic is it to review this all in that time scale? And how realistic is it to actually come up with a solution when you're trying to change values and ethos in the midst of all that? Because is it an issue of values and ethos? Because how do you alter that? Can you alter that? Yeah. Is that part of your remit?
So, so that's one of the questions that rattles around in my head every day. And in setting out the case for change, so the issues that we've seen, I've tried to draw out the themes as well as some of the specific issues, because you could just look at the system and come up with, you know, 500 specific points. Lots of them do fit into these themes of issues around, you know, how we have a service that is more often low stigma, families welcome, help is available when it's needed, that when it comes to child protection cases and concerns about significant harm, we intervene with good quality, swift decision-making, and that there is help and support around a family at that crisis point to really test out whether or not the family can safely stay together, that we look at some of these cycles, particularly for parents who themselves have been in care, where children are removed and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
And then care, the care system itself, where actually lots of what we see that happens, there's a lot of really good stuff, often attributed to exceptional professionals and care workers. But there's a lot of what we see which breaks rather than builds relationships. And so for me, the question is, how do we dig a bit deeper underneath what we're seeing in those problems and actually tackle some of the root causes rather than, you know, just coming up with 500 incremental tweaks? And this is where the Jenga tower analogy is important, that I use, which gets very mixed. What do you say, Al?
People have just loved that. It's like, you know, I'm surprised people haven't been sending them to your house.
Well, there might be some already in the post, but we could end up with this review just adding to a very complicated system.
Yeah.
And making it more fragile through more incremental change. And I think what we're doing in the next few months is we're going to be doing some more in-depth work in about six areas across the country, with services and crucially with families. So we're going to go very deep in some of those six areas, doing some ethnographic work with families and children involved in children's social care, to sort of dig a bit deeper beyond the case for change. Why is it that we're seeing some of these things happen, and what could be some of the smaller number of very significant changes that we might be able to recommend that are about values and culture and ethos rather than just about rules and regulations and guidance. Because there are so many examples that I have seen even in the last 3 months, I was aware of some of them before that, where rules have been introduced, guidance been introduced, really well-intentioned, and the way it's been implemented, it just loses all of the spirit of the reason it was introduced. So for an example, this group of young women I met last week about housing issues, you know, the £2,000 grant for care leavers setting up their own home. One of them sent me a document after the meeting from their local authority, which details by item how much money they can spend from that £2,000 on scissors, toasters, a rug. They can only get a rug if there's no good quality flooring, that they need to look for these items secondhand first, and that the actual list of items comes to less than £2,000. And there's a limit on how much money they can spend per item. And so instead of that really, really good idea, that really good policy being implemented on the ground by trusting personal assistants or social workers, sit down with the young person and say, look, £2,000 might sound like a lot of money, but you know what we need to do is we need to do a budget. Yeah. What do you like? What do you want your house to look and feel like? You know, here's some places we can go and look, and let's do a little budget. You know, it's completely lost. And not just that, I read it and I was really angry, because that document strips all dignity from anyone in that process. It basically says to you, we're going to go secondhand. We don't trust you to buy
scissors.
We don't trust you to buy a tea towel that doesn't cost more than £3. I mean, it's complete stuff like that is happening all over a lot of the system, and it's not going to be fixed by more bricks being added to the Jenga tower. Some of that stuff's about behaviours and culture, and it needs to change.
That's
almost saying it's actually saying you're not worthy of having, you know, of having a great start when it comes to your formal independence. And I find that quite shocking that, you know, that would. I'm not surprised.
Worse than giving them no money.
Yeah, exactly.
It's humiliating. I'm just from the idea being floated through to all the layers in which it then gets interpreted and implemented. Every step of the way, I'm absolutely sure there are good people making decisions which are well-intentioned, but the effect of it is a translation of intention to action, which leaves people feeling unloved, uncared for, and not
untrusted.
Valued.
Untrusted.
Yep. Untrusted.
You can't be trusted with $2,000 to buy to finish house. It's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely shocking.
Can I just pop in here, Alan? Because obviously,
please do, because
adoption and fostering podcast. What have you picked out about adoption? Because there's a little bit of comment about there not being very much about adoption in your report, but actually, there's quite a lot about adoption in the report if you read it.
Yeah, exactly. So we spoke to a lot of adopters, had a lot of help from some great organisations who connected us with communities of adopters. And we also spoke to some adults who were adopted as children as well, which there were some really powerful conversations, particularly about contact with birth parents, birth families. And I think some of what we heard from adopters, and we also spoke to a lot of foster carers as well, I guess with both groups, there were some common themes about needing to battle to get help, the feeling like you needed to get into quite an oppositional position with the service in order to get the help you felt you needed, which when you're already caring for children, which in any circumstances is a lot of work, takes a lot out of you, is a joy and amazing, but also exhausting and draining, to then be in battle with a service to get help is not the sort of position you want to be in. So there are some common themes there, which I think are reflected, as I say, again, for parents of children with disabilities. And we've had a lot of conversations with the parent carer forums, which have been great. So there's been some common themes there. There are some specific issues around fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which have come up a lot, particularly for adopters. And I think, I mean, it'd be interesting to know kind of how that shifted over time and whether the children who are now being adopted compared to children who were being adopted 30 years ago, that's kind of reflected in some of the issues that we're now seeing for babies that are being adopted. And a kind of lack of knowledge sometimes around what the signs might be, and even awareness amongst prospective adopters. And foster carers. So some issues there that were a bit more, I guess, a bit more specific. And then we make quite a big point around the work that's been done on adoption in the last decade, which has been a government priority, has shown some positive results in terms of speed of adoption process, the adoption support fund being introduced. And actually that same level of government focus does now need to be given to other routes to giving children safe, stable, loving homes. So that's one point we make, which is not to say the focus on adoption has been wrong. It hasn't. It's actually that same level of energy and verve from government now needs to be spent on other areas.
I think definitely the parallel is kinship and special guardianships, where there's a huge, you know, very comparable circumstances often, but children who are just kind of, just not on the agenda. I found it really interesting reading some of the other aspects of your report, thinking about family help and the need for good quality family help, timely family help. I thought that actually that is the crux of it for a lot of people around adoption support. If we take away the word adoption and just say it's... Because often the issue is children who've experienced adversity, you know, children with special educational needs and disabilities. The cohorts are very similar with that added frisson of adoption, but...
Yeah.
Some of that stuff crosses over really easily, doesn't it? It's
completely
agree. Really help.
Yeah, completely agree. And the other big point we make, and I guess the thing to say is that these are areas which have been given quite a lot of attention and focus in other reviews quite recently. Kinship hasn't, so I wanted to make sure that kinship got a big focus, and we're going to keep a focus on that that group of families in the next stage of the review as well, but for fostering this issue, which hasn't been addressed, which is around the demographic challenge to come. You know, 20, I think we say it's 20% of foster carers are now over 60, you know, which is significant. And given the importance of foster carers to the whole system, you know, it is the backbone of children's social care and the care system. I am really worried that we've got so much interest in fostering at that initial stage, and yet we're approving so few. Not because they go through the process and they get rejected. They go through the process and leave the process. And that's a, you know, an important point that we make.
I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, recently I did a preparation to foster course and there's 20 plus people on it. And it's got come through to one applicant who's going through the process now. Wow. So, but I think that from my perspective, I'm not here to get my opinion, but
it'll be interesting to hear it. Yeah.
Is that often people dip in and out of their desire to move to fostering, and then they kind of, they come and they go, can I do it now? And they go, maybe not now. My kids are too young. Or maybe not now. I don't have a spare room. Maybe not now. And it is very much the ones that go through are the ones you catch at the right moment. And they may have been thinking about it for years before they got to that point. So, but it's like you say, you know, we know that, and what we say where I work is, you know, until they're approved, they're not approved. You can't count on a thing until they've got children. There's all counts for nothing.
Yeah. Do you think though, Al, there's something about, so if we've got this demographic challenge headed our way and we have got this group of people that are really interested, is it that we're not attracting people to fostering in enough numbers who would be right for it and right for the children who need it? Or is it that actually within that 137,000 inquiries, we probably do have the people there who are interested enough in this, who with a bit of support, a bit of understanding, because I've spoken to people who've gone through the fostering process and have said that at certain stages of it, and this is really mixed depending on kind of who does which agency does the training and stuff, the messages that are given are don't take account of even the points that are made in the fostering stock take by Martin Neri about not hugging kids, you know.
I'm not sure that I know what you mean.
Something in it which sort of gives a message to people of, you know, this is a job which might do where this won't be like caring for a child who's your own.
Which makes people say, well, actually, I think people do come with a romanticized version of fostering. I think the same with adoption. I think that people go, all right, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to be helping kids and it's going to be great. And it's all be, you know, tears and, you know, the newspaper articles sort of indicate, you know, Mr. and Mrs. who did 400,000 children and have got an MBE in the age of 80. It's very romanticized. And I think the reality is when people sometimes come and you go, actually, but you need to do your daily logs. And they go, what do you mean? I go, well, you have to write down what's going on because we need to know. That's some of that stuff puts people off. But I do think that people dip in and out. It'd be lovely. It'd be interesting to see how many of those 130,000, if you could do a longitudinal study and go, well, how many people who were approved and went to, how many times had they had contact before that this was maybe the end of a process for them, and the other people are just at the middle or the beginning of a process? Because we find lots of people who dip in and out with our service and kind of go, actually, it's not right now, or
come,
you know,
back to you in 2 years, or
yeah, the dog's ill, we're going to wait till the dog dies, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. Really pragmatic things, or the or even we've had it where people have sort of said, I wanted to start, but my daughter's returned from university and that wasn't the plan. We love her, so we better keep her. that sort of thing. But that's interesting that all of that's on the agenda, and I find it really fascinating. I'm looking at the time and I'm aware that you are coming to the end of your time, or have you got more time?
I can do, should we go to 5 past?
Boop, boop. If you've got...
It's a good conversation, so yeah, very happy to carry on. Let me just... ping a message to somebody.
You'll get my people to talk to your people. Fax them a memo.
No, I'm due to meet somewhere else. So I just need to
tell the minister to go and walk through the block a bit. You know, kick their heels. I mean, that is one of the questions I was wanting to ask, is how has the interim sort of report been received at governmental level? Did they read it? Well, I mean, realistically, ministers don't read 100-page documents, do they? Someone comes to them and tells them the high points. So what's been the feedback?
They have read it. And as well as having read it, I've also had meetings with ministers over the course of the review so far where I'm saying to them, look, here's what I'm hearing, here's what we're finding, here's some of the themes and issues. And I've been impressed by the level of interest across government, not just from the DfE, but also met with ministers and senior officials at the Treasury, Number 10, DWP, MHCLG. So, and that's important, which a Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government.
I was going to say, you're just running off letters at me now. I'm
sorry.
My mind isn't that quick. I got DfE, but after that, it was
spaghetti of departments. But I mean, serious point is that children's social care isn't just a DfE issue, right? These issues that we're describing as problems cut across government departments. So their interest and understanding of it's good. I think since publishing it, already we've had officials at the DfE say, okay, well, how are we going to, what might some of the solutions be? And I'm saying, yeah, I mean, that's great. That's kind of where you want officials to be headed as a response to something like this being published. We do need to take a bit of time to figure out what the right recommendations might be. That's the stage that we're now in. We're not rushing to answers. But there's been interest in it. And I think the messages that have been in the report are saying, this is, you know, we are not doing this well enough. I'm not laying that at the door of social workers, a particular service, a particular government, because as I said earlier, you know, some of these issues are long trend lines that have been going on, and not just across different Conservative governments, but across different governments, Labour and Conservative. And actually, there is something powerful in accepting that we collectively have not got this right, not in a defensive way, not in a way which says, yeah, but we've tried really hard. It's just because all of these other things haven't worked. You know, Ofsted's giving us a hard time. We've not got enough money, other services. That's not a healthy space in which to consider what we might need to change and what we need to do differently. And I have been impressed that so far ministers and government departments have taken that approach of saying, you know, this is not pretty. These are tricky issues. And clearly we're not doing well enough. You know, they are interested in what it is we're going to recommend, as everyone else is. So that will be the sort of test of government commitment to this, really.
Because, I mean, I think it's not unreasonable to say that, you know, social care staff tend to be left-leaning and the Conservative government are centre right. And so it is a bit of oil and water. So there's just this inbuilt cynicism or suspicion, I guess. That's hard to get over, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm left-leaning. You know, I'm a member of the Labour Party. So I get that. People vote and we get a government, and people voted and we've got a Conservative government. Yeah. Now, you can either say, look, we're not, therefore, everything that happens, everything that gets done, you know, we're going to be completely oppositional to, we're not going to engage with. Or you can say, look, politics draws in a diverse crowd, even within political parties. And the vast majority of those people want to do good things. They want to make things better. Yeah. In a world where making things happen is really bloody hard. And actually, I think that's the space the government are in. And you don't need to kind of wade into everything the government thinks or says or support everything they do. But we've got a government right now saying, we don't know how to, you know, we don't know the answers for improving children's social care. That's why we're doing a review. Come to the table. We might not agree on everything, but we want to make address these issues. So that's what the review is about. That's the approach I'm taking. And as I say, the government response and engagement so far has been good.
Excellent. Our time's up, isn't it, Scott?
It is. You've talked enough, Al.
Thank you. I feel like I've asked too many questions.
I've definitely talked enough.
I think the thing is, though, we could sit and talk for 3 hours about this and we would still not come to a natural end with it. And I think, you know, that's kind of one of the things. And you said, you know, you've kind of invited yourself back onto the podcast at some point, Josh.
I know you'll take me from that. Towards the end of the review would be a good time to do that, right? Where we might be able to pick up on some of the...
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there would be no end to discussing that. And, you know, Al and I can sit in a room and talk about fostering adoption and all that sort of stuff for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And we would never come to a natural conclusion on it. So, you know, this can go on for forever, really. And that's, you know, you can't squeeze everything into an hour and 5 minutes.
No,
so,
what are you going to do? You know,
An hour and 5 minutes is a good time, though. I might move my meetings to an hour and 5 minutes, gives you that extra, squeezes that extra bit of conversation. Can I, if I take it to an hour and 6 minutes, can I say one more thing, which is about the kind of stage that we're in at the minute, where we've put the case for change out there, and it, having been written by human beings, there will be things that we might have missed or misunderstood in putting the case for change together. And so we are asking people, again, this is a little bit different for a review. We put something out quite early on, but we're saying to people, if there's stuff that we've not quite captured right, or that, you know, is important that we've missed, please do tell us. And there's a link in the document that allows people to do that. We're also asking some fairly big questions in the document, which I think open up the space for us to get into together about what recommendations might be. And again, on that, really keen to hear from lots of different people. We're going to be doing events over the summer as well that allow people to participate in some of that discussion. So it really is just the start of the conversation about a lot of this stuff.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks for having me. And
you're welcome.
It's been a good conversation.
And we'll see you in late spring next year.
yeah, exactly. Spring. You'll see me in the season of spring. Not autumn 2022.
Not autumn, yeah. Excellent. Great, all right. Well, thank you very much, Josh. And please apologise to the minister, whoever you kicked off for the next meeting.
I will apologise for being 7 minutes late, but it was for a very good reason.
Cheers, then.
Good to meet you. Good to see you again, Al. And really nice to meet you, Scott.
Cheers. Okay, cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Take care. See ya.
I thought it was interesting. I mean...
It was, yeah.
He's an affable guy.
Yes, I mean, you know what? Even after listening to this and some of the stuff he said, there will still be people who, you know, have got the pitchforks out, and you know, that's their prerogative, I guess. I think when he was talking about nuances and all the kind of, we will always see what we want to see in some occasions, and I get why some people might be upset and all that sort of stuff, but you know, actually. I still have no opinion on its independence and stuff like that. I'm not convinced either way on this. So, you know, for me, he was a guy who's trying to do a job, and you know, we've all been criticised for stuff that we've done in the past. But you know, whatever, it's you know, he's trying to do a job.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my experience of anything we've done with the DfE is that the people who commission stuff want to trust that the person who's going to do it is going to do it well. You're not going to get your arch enemy just to prove a point of independence, are you? You're going to get people you kind of get on with.
Yeah.
And so that can look like chumism, or whatever that phrase is.
Yeah, yeah. But look at some of the organizations that are funded for various different things from the DfE, you know, a lot of the charities and you know, I'm talking about adoption, fostering charities, but all those sorts of things. So, you know, if you then had, you know, and I'm not dismissing the fact that Josh was a high school teacher and then became, you know, a social worker and started up a charity. Yeah. I'm not dismissing that. But what I'm saying is that you could say that for a lot of the different, you know, things. And you and I do some stuff with the DfE, you know, but we don't get massive grants. So does that make us independent of the DfE? You know?
You could go round and round. The proof is in the pudding, isn't it? The proof is in the tasting. Yeah, what's the review going to say? 5 years from now, will we look back and go, well, that was a waste of time? Or will we go,
that
did a good job of it?
I will say one thing, though, and if anybody picked up on it, that's good. When I asked if any of his opinions or ideas had changed, he didn't actually answer the question. So I took that as a no. So there
you go. Oh, you are Paxman, aren't you?
I'll tell you. I was going to say at the time, but I thought he was, you know, he was answering quite
he was on the floor. Didn't want to upset him.
Yeah, I know. Awesome. Yeah.
One thing we should do before we go is we should just, can we point people towards our new website?
We can, because this is out on Saturday. So we'll be 3 days into having launched
our little adventure.
A little journey.
So we've got a new website called noborderstraining.org. Did I say that right? Because I know
you said that right. Well done. Yeah.
Noborderstraining.org.
You've done it wrong, but
yeah. Right now. And I guess our aspiration is that off the back of all the podcast and all of the links and networks we've done and all of the different people we've drawn in, we wanted to provide a forum to do training, really. And that's not just adoption and fostering. It's all kind of different aspects of parenting, looking after children who've experienced all kinds of different difficult experiences. So if you go on to the noborderstraining.org, see? Good.
Yeah.
Well, and you can see we've got some courses there coming up about, you know, all kinds of things about developing resilience, about, you know, chronic loss and sorrow, nonviolence, resistance. We've also got our annual yearly doodah, haven't
yeah.
we?
Yeah. Yeah. Which has got November. All the names on it. And we haven't really talked about that much, but, you know, all the links are there. So essentially the training there's a brief synopsis on the website, but then you can follow the link and you go to Eventbrite to read more about it. There's a lot more detail there, as well as the costs. But worthwhile saying that the training will continue to be added. There will be taster sessions, there will be freebies, there will be paid for stuff. It's a real mix. But there's also a lot of resources on there, which we will build on over time. And those resources are kind of links and websites and things like that. And, yeah. and that's all free to access. But like anything, it's a journey, it's a process. We will, you know, we will develop and we will, you know, change and get with it. But yeah. It's also the new home to this, to the Adoption and Fostering podcast as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've never had a home before. It's like having a parent. So we've got this podcast, we've got the No Borders podcast, so that's all going to sit in noborderstraining.org.
Now, if I was a conspiracy theorist, I would think that the whole ruse of getting Josh McAllister on was to kind of, there's a massive advert for that, and that Josh McAllister was probably on the board of directors of No Borders and getting... But he's not.
But then if we were going to do that, then we'd have done that at the beginning, wouldn't we?
Oh, damn. Once again.
Yeah, exactly. So
hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
But are you generally okay, Scott?
Yeah, so generally fine, Al. Thank you.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I am as well, just in case you're
interested. I was going to say, I don't really care, to be honest, this week.
Fine. Well, on that note, bon Jovi. Yes.
And Jovi.